badquaker.com podcast. And welcome back to badquaker.com podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 27th. I had to look it up because I have no idea what day it is from one day to the next. Today is Wednesday, April 27th.
Well, it changes every day.
I know. How are you supposed to keep up with that? 2011, and this is our second podcast. Kai is with me. I'm Ben. And we're here talking about pretty much anything that comes up that we talk about over the course of the week. But mostly it's centered around freedom, anarcho-capitalism, and just living an individual life and not being bothered by other people telling you how to live your life. Last week, we talked about Jeffrey Tucker's review of the movie Beowulf, and Kai did a review of Jeffrey Tucker's review, and we had a lot of fun with that. One of the things that Kai mentioned during that was Hollywood doesn't have a tendency to show a lot of respect to anarchists or libertarians in general. And we kind of touched on that a little bit, but we wanted to cover it a little bit more in depth today. And I'm actually going to come to the defense of Hollywood with a couple of movies that they did that were very libertarian or even very anarchical. So we'll touch on that. And I'll just start with that. One movie that a lot of people don't know about, it's an old movie. It was called Talk of the Town, starred Cary Grant. And in the movie, Cary Grant played an anarchist. He was young, early 20s, outspoken, in a small town that was pretty much owned by an evil corporation that ran a factory and owned the mayor and owned the police department and they were totally corrupt and stupid. And if the factory burns, and of course, it's the anarchist's fault, because everybody knows that's all anarchists do is kill and burn, right? That's sarcasm. So, of course, the heroine of the movie realizes that the anarchist did not do this crime. And then, as they say, mayhem ensues, and it's a fun show. Cary Grant portrays the anarchist in a very positive light, and it's a very enjoyable movie. Somehow it got past the Hollywood establishment.
Well, they had a war going on at the time.
Yeah.
They were kind of just producing anything and everything.
That's true. It was, I think it was released in 1942. It was actually put out, or it was actually filmed in 41. So between the latter part of 1941 and 1942, that's exactly why it was able to slip past them.
Probably was nothing else that they could put out.
The classic, in my opinion, the classic libertarian movie is the Japanese movie The Seven Samurai. It doesn't have a vast amount of popularity. It's kind of a little cult following. Not a lot of people know about it. And most of the people who know it and like it maybe don't even realize they're watching a purely libertarian movie. There's no state apparent at all in the movie. You have a little village that's just living the perfect libertarian or anarchical life with no enforced government whatsoever, just the people getting along with one another and treating each other as humans. And then you have a band of robbers that comes in and raids the village on every harvest, and they take whatever they want and they abuse the people the way that they want to. And so the townspeople get together, and they don't have much wealth, but they take what they have and they go and they hire champions, mercenaries. And of course, they're not called mercenaries in the film, they're samurai. But in real life, that's what the samurai were. They were mercenaries, they were champions, they were heroes. And so they come, these seven samurai, come to the village, and they teach the people how to defend themselves. Some of them die in the process of defending the village, and that's the point of the movie. Now, Hollywood took this script almost word for word and made a really good movie out of it, The Magnificent Seven. And a lot of, that's like a really male-oriented movie. A lot of guys like that. There's heroes, there's horses, there's Yul Brynner. It's got everything that's perfect for a great Western. And people don't even realize that it's purely libertarian.
Which is the difference between those movies and Talk of the Town. In Talk of the Town, he was an anarchist, and they talked about him being an anarchist, but they never actually show anarchy.
Right.
It's the main point is that he is an anarchist, but they don't actually go into any of the details of anarchist theory or libertarian tradition.
Right.
Whereas in these movies, they don't necessarily call it anarchy or libertarianism. They just show it. They just show that that's what it is.
Exactly. And it's and when you watch these two movies, The Seven Samurai and The Magnificent Seven, it's entirely plausible. The plot is entirely plausible because it happened over and over and over, both in ancient Japan and in the American West. These kind of things did happen. So it's not hard at all to imagine a situation like that. The comedic remake of those was an enjoyable little film called Three Amigos. It has pretty much the same plot, with a lot of goofiness and a lot of fun. But you still maintain this whole idea of the perfect little libertarian village minding its own business and having to hire someone to come in and act as the mercenary and get rid of the bad guys. And in all these three movies, the comedic one, the Three Amigos, and the other two as well, you have a very small group of heroes and a very large group of thieves. And yet, good wins, because that's what happens in real life. And it doesn't seem like good wins a lot of times when you're fighting bad. But in the long run, good wins. And that's what makes a good movie, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people want to see. That's what they want to believe. Because really, if that's not true, you know, what's the use?
Yeah.
Then we were going to touch on the exact opposite, or not really the exact opposite, but that which is perverted, taken this wonderful pattern and then perverted it. Was a little movie, a Disney version of The Three Amigos and The Seven Samurai called It's a Bug's Life. And it was a fun movie. I liked the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to sit there and watch it and everything. But
and on the surface, you would think that it's the same plot line. You have this group of ants that are harassed by the grasshopper. And, you know, you think it's the same plot line.
Yeah. Except you have this inventor, this innovator, this free thinker that... And you have the opposite of that. You have a queen. You have the state. And the free thinker is a problem to the state, constantly a problem to the state. He made a mistake and gets himself arrested by the state.
Yeah, because his innovation, his little technology didn't work quite right, and the state arrested him for it because he was a terrorist. Domestic extremist.
So then he has to go out and hire the champions to come and rescue. But of course, in the Disney version, the champions are actors. Well, circus actors. Same thing. That you can leave that to Disney to twist the version that way. Although, I guess, you know, in the Three Amigos, they were
actors.
They were
too.
Actors as well. But, you know, at least they actually... fought. And they sang and danced.
This is true. It's the whole package.
My little buttercup. But in the Disney version, the hero is the innovator who gets arrested and then has to redeem himself. He actually, didn't he escape?
Yeah, I think... It's been a while since I watched it, but I think he escaped and went and got the circus animals.
Right.
And then kind of convinced the state that the circus animals were going to help him, and then that kind of failed.
Yeah, because in the Disney version, of course, the heroes are not heroes, they're buffoons. And that's a lot more like what you would see from Hollywood in mm-hmm. depicting a mercenary anyway.
Right.
A private security of any kind. They're going to show them as being evil or fools or complete buffoons, you know.
And then lo and behold, what ends up saving them in the end is the state usurping the technology that it was trying to suppress all along.
Which is what the state does. They resist technology. They beat up the inventor. They do everything they can to hold back the inventions. And then, once they recognize the utility of the invention to expand the state, they take it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they either monopolize it through their own choice companies, or they use it strictly for, say, war, or to hold down the people in one way or the other. They pervert the technology, and they stop the innovation process in doing so.
And then they lie. They tell you that without them, there would be no technology and no innovation. And they say, oh, well, war creates technology.
Yeah.
No, it's the exact opposite. War destroys things. It can't do anything other than that. The state can never create things. It can only steal things and destroy things.
On a side note, that's something that always kind of almost makes me laugh if it didn't make me want to cry, is you'll hear this said, well, you know, war will, an economy will recover because of war. War will somehow help an economy. Now, how can breaking things and killing people help an economy?
Yeah.
You know, oh, well, during World War II, there was no unemployment. There was no unemployment because you drafted all those guys, put guns in their hands, and started killing each other with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no unemployment because
you enslaved everyone.
Yeah. How can there be unemployment when everybody's either working to make bombs or getting blown up by bombs?
You know, it's funny, there was no unemployment among the blacks before the Civil War in the South either.
Hey, that sounds like the state would love that. Well, the state did love slavery. The state provided the mechanism for slavery, and the state kept slavery going artificially much longer than it would have been any other way. We can do a whole podcast on that topic alone.
But getting back to technology, there are plenty of instances and examples that you can point to where the state has taken a technology and removed it from the free market and squashed innovation.
I like to fall back on the obvious on that one, and that's computers. In the 1930s, the birth of the modern computer took place with these really hideous looking vacuum tube run computers that were just massive, and they would produce a tremendous amount of heat. They were very noisy, and they used a lot of electricity. And basically what they did was add numbers. Now, we have computers today, and you look at a computer and you think, oh, this is an amazing thing. All it's doing is adding ones and zeros.
Yeah.
That's all it does. It's on its simplest form, if you get down to the machine language that runs the computer, it's nothing but on and off, on and off, on and off. 1 0 1 0 1 0. And when that technology was birthed in the 1930s, using these vacuum tube computers, the state looked at that, and I would mention, it wasn't the state that invented it. It was individuals without the state that invented it. But when the state, when it came within the range of the state's eyesight, the state locked it up immediately and didn't allow any outside businesses to get a hold of it.
And we should point out that it wasn't because the state saw potential in it. It's not because the state, you know, went, oh, we could do this and that with it. The state just wanted it.
Yeah.
Without understanding it, it just wanted it.
Which is a characteristic that you see the state on it. We could go into a lot of different examples. The one thing the state did recognize that the computer was good for was to control the trajectory and the firing technicalities of naval ships. So they saw this computer as a way to crunch numbers to control the fire of naval batteries. When I'm saying fire, I'm not talking about like a campfire. I'm talking about the firing of its guns. To control the firing to aim and control the firing of the naval batteries. That was the only purpose they saw for a computer. And then, as individual innovators working within the captives of the state, they saw the second use for the computer, and that was to control bombs that were being dropped from airplanes, again, to just basically control the flight and the trajectory of bombs falling from airplanes. So a computer is now available to the market. The state yanks it off the market and can only see one value in it, and that's to control destruction in a war.
Yeah, because when you get to its heart, all a state can do is steal, kill, and lie. That's all the state can do. They cannot innovate. They cannot make new things.
They can't innovate. They can't produce new things. They can't even, the state cannot even produce enough to keep itself alive. It has to steal in order to keep itself alive. And it can't convince you honestly to give to it, so mm-hmm. it has to lie to you. And if you don't give to it, it will kill you.
And the only way with computers that they were able to get around this is this other technology that popped up that the state looked at and went, well, that's useless. I can't use that for killing anybody.
You're talking about transistors and the, sure.
Right.
Back in the late 40s, there were a couple companies who really wanted to take computers out to the business world and open them up to, like, accounting departments and things like that. And the state resisted that because they saw this technology as, weapons only. And so these companies, this little pocket of monopoly companies that the state had authorized, they were desperate for a wider customer base than just selling to the state. And so in the late 40s and early 50s, they convinced the state to release certain types of computers to certain types of industry so that they could have it for accounting purposes. And the computers were still huge and hideous, and they could do almost nothing, but they could count, and that's so they use them. But what, Kai, what you're talking about there is in the late 50s, when transistors became available, the desire to help Japan rebuild its crushed economy, the state allowed companies to sell the technology to the Japanese so that they could make a harmless little device, the transistor radio. And the state didn't see any harm in letting Japanese companies produce transistor radios in huge quantities and sell them back to America. That seemed like something that the state saw no harm in. And from the state's point of view, they didn't really see a benefit. They couldn't steal anything from it. So they figured, well, they'd get some tax money out of it anyway, import fees and that kind of thing. The problem was, what the state couldn't see was that bare technology that created those little transistor radios with the knowledge that computers were, you could do amazing things with this simple 101010 technology. By the end of the 60s, people were starting to put two and two together here and figure out that there was something else available to them. And by the 70s, you had guys hiding in their mom's garage making real computers. Computers that could do stuff other than make bombs hit targets. Because really, somebody will say, well, but we use computers to get to the moon. All we did was fire a bomb at a target.
Yeah.
The fact that it didn't blow up when it got there because we had men in it, it's not the point. It was that rocket
didn't blow up that time.
Yeah, the whole purpose of that was to show that we could basically carry nuclear capabilities around the world. But anyway, that's another podcast too. But so there we were in the 70s, and the government did not realize that it had let the cat out of the bag.
Yeah, because the state didn't understand the technology to begin with, because the state didn't have the capacity to create that technology, so it didn't understand it. It didn't know what it did. It didn't know why it did it. It didn't know what it was capable of doing. All it knew was, this technology we can steal and use for war and destruction, and that technology is useless. Mm-hmm. It's just a little toy. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Without, because they doesn't, the state didn't understand that it's the same technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so they released this, they released the printing press onto the world, and they didn't even understand that that's what they had done.
Yeah, a modern version of the printing press. You know, if the state, in its disjointed and very infantile stage that it was in when the actual printing press was invented, if the state had had the intelligence to recognize what the printing press was in Gutenberg's day, Gutenberg would have been a dead man.
Yeah.
And there would have been nothing but, you know, little broken...
And his entire town would have been burned.
Yeah. But at the time, the state was so infantile and weak that it didn't recognize the threat. That reminds me as well as one of my pet peeves well, it's not a pet peeve. It's something that I greatly appreciate. It's the opposite of pet peeve. I greatly appreciate the state's stupidity. But I've talked about this before. The state, in its various forms, because in a sense, the church was filling... Not to the same extent as the state does now, but the state was the church was fulfilling certain aspects of the state during different times in mm-hmm. history, and when education in the late 1700s and early 1800s began to be common among common people,
mm-hmm.
the state didn't recognize the threat. And so for 100 years, from about 1800 to about 1900, there was a lot of free thinking and there was a lot of education that was entirely privately done.
Yep.
And the state didn't recognize the threat until about the time that Thomas Dewey figured this out. You can't get much more of a state than Dewey.
Yeah.
When Dewey figured this out, of course, his love for the state... He recognized immediately that you have to crush education, otherwise free-thinking people will kill the state.
Yep.
And so, you know, that's exactly what he did. If the state would have been smart enough, they could have stopped education much easier in 1800.
Yeah.
But the state is so dull-witted, and it can't even think for itself, that they, you know...
Yeah.
It's always behind the curve. It's behind the curve on the...
With computers, it's only now starting to understand that it made a giant mistake in letting this be free.
Yeah.
And it's frantically trying to grab a hold of this technology and control it. And the problem there is they've let it go too long.
Yeah, you mentioned Egypt, what happened in Egypt recently, you know, and that's a perfect example. You know, the state in Egypt responded to the protesters the way it always responds. It comes out with brute force, and it cuts off communications, and it does the basic standard stuff that states do, and the people just adjusted to that.
Yep.
And okay, we're going to cut off your internet so you can't use Facebook and Twitter. Really? Watch this. I have a cell phone.
Yeah. Yeah, you... And because technology right now is moving at a pace that is quicker and quicker and quicker every single year, the state's having more and more and more trouble keeping up with it. And so when the state cracks down on one aspect of technology, six ways to overcome that pop up.
Mm-hmm.
Because suddenly you don't have three guys in the garage with only themselves to bounce ideas off of.
Yeah.
You have every person in the world that you can talk to.
Yeah, it's really pretty amazing if you think about it, the potential of what we have coming at us right now. And the state is just frantically, you can see them with the different attempts they've made in the last couple of years to get control of the internet. Their attack on online gaming. Now, why would they attack online gaming? I mean, really, from a tactical point of view, if you imagine yourself as the state, why are you worried about online gaming? Yeah. Are you really so moral that you think that people are harmed by this immoral gambling. Well, of course the state doesn't believe that way. The state runs the lottery.
Yeah.
Well, is this okay? So it's competition. The state's afraid of competition. Well, the state is afraid of competition. But online poker is not in competition with scratch-offs.
Yeah.
It's not the competition.
Yeah.
So why? Why did they do it? Because they can.
Because they can't regulate online poker.
They saw something that somebody else had that they couldn't have. And so that can't be. We have to crush that. And this is also a practice run where as it learns how to crush online poker, eventually it'll learn how to crush social networking, et cetera, et cetera, email. You know, the aspects of the state have been desperately trying to figure out how to control email.
Yeah.
And they almost have it with, I understand, I don't get into all the paranoid aspects of it, but from what I understand, they pretty much have figured out how to control email.
Yep.
But
the problem that the online community faces right now is that we are dependent upon corporations to allow us access to the internet.
Mm. The gatekeepers.
Yeah. And I think that that is only the case because there's no reason not to right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once those fall, you're going to see people popping up all over the place, you know, getting onto the internet without those companies.
Yeah, private networks popping up, private ways to get onto the internet, possibly even, you know, I was reading something the other day about using radio waves because digital technology, you're still just talking ones and zeros.
Yeah.
Well, that's Morse code. Morse code, you know, is ones and zeros. That's all it really is. And so all of computer information can be transmitted over a radio wave.
And once that technology breaks free, game over.
The state can't,
you know,
restrain
you can
it.
Shut down the internet right now mm-hmm. because you can shut down the companies that run the internet.
Yeah.
But you can't stop radio waves from being broadcast.
Imagine the state, imagine the future, and the state has vans that drive around trying to catch all the hacker, all the pirate radio stations mm-hmm. that are transmitting the internet of the future. And, you know, how long did it take us to think of that workaround right here, right now?
Yeah.
You know,
and we are not computer savvy people.
Right.
I was computer savvy 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I don't know how computers work now. They've changed so much in 10 years that I can't even find where my basic settings on my computer are anymore.
Yeah, the state tries to shut down the internet, and groups like Anonymous and people like that are just going to amaze the world with what they can come up with.
And they're chomping at the bit to do it.
Oh, yeah.
They are.
They almost want the challenge. It's really a shame that we don't have more anarcho-capitalists within the hacker movement because they're so anarcho-capitalist.
Yep.
You know, you look at something like the Linux and everything that came out of all that.
Yep.
The anti-copyright movement and the ridiculous attempts to enforce copyright laws. All those things are exactly the opposite of anarcho-capitalism and libertarianism. And you know, those people are so enthusiastic about sharing files and about all this stuff, and you're acting out what we believe and what we say. And a lot of them don't even realize it.
Yep.
Well, I think we ought to wrap it up. We wasted people's time here today talking about crazy stuff. And, of course, let's have a disclaimer. Everything we said is made up and means absolutely nothing.
Absolutely. We're just two crazy people sitting in a basement talking into a microphone.
Well, you're not crazy. I'm actually certifiable, but you don't have any evidence that you're crazy.
That's true. I passed the test and they let me out.
You have a stamp?
I...
Did they stamp your hand sane? Okay.
I got my certificate.
There you go. Well, thanks a lot, folks. We appreciate you listening to us. If you didn't hear last week's podcast, it's available at badquaker.com. And we do appreciate you listening. Be sure to leave us any feedback you might have about this. Thanks a lot, folks.